Yes, of course, the business and economic news you need to know. That's the usual around here. Also, though, today, we'll talk soccer a little bit from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 22nd day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, voting rights is on the agenda today in the Senate to try by that body to begin debate on what congressional Democrats say is their biggest priority. But we direct your attention on this Tuesday to the other side of the rotunda and a hearing by the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis. Guest of honor, one Jerome Powell. There was the usual potpourri of congressional questions for the Fed chair and his usual catalog of answers. In his remarks, though, Chair Powell did take pains to point out that the worst of the corona recession has fallen mostly on Black and Hispanic Americans, noting specifically how their unemployment rate is still disproportionately high. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going with a look into that.
The overall unemployment rate for May was 5.8%. The rate for Hispanic workers was more than a percentage point above that. For Black workers, more than 3 percentage points higher.
And so it's like, well, why is that?
Kristen Brody is an economist at the Brookings Institution.
I think much of it is structural racism. When you think about who was able to get vaccinated first, it was people that had broadband who probably had jobs.
Brody says people of color may have less access to training and education, or employers might discriminate against job applicants because of their race. Rebecca Given, who teaches labor studies at Rutgers University, says it's also
the ability to live in a place with good transportation, quality housing, access to affordable childcare.
If you don't have housing, transportation, or childcare, it's hard to work. Also, Given says Black and Hispanic workers are more likely to have low-paid service positions, and some of those jobs were automated during the pandemic. Tulane University economist Gary Hoover says we won't see those jobs again.
Remember, there was a time when we had elevator operators. That's a job, once it left, it never came back and never will.
Hoover says it could take more than 4 years for the unemployment rate for Black and Hispanic workers to get back to where it was before the pandemic, which even then was higher than the overall jobless rate. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You might remember, but maybe not. It's been busy, I know, that back in May, President Biden said the United States would send 80 million vaccines to other countries by the end of June. We're almost there, and less than 10 million doses are reported to have been sent so far. There is no shortage of vaccines, the White House says. It's a logistics thing. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the increasingly busy supply chain desk today.
A lot needs to happen to get vaccines from one country to another and into people's arms.
You don't want to just put vaccines on a plane, wave goodbye, and hope for the best.
Joshua Michaud at the Kaiser Family Foundation says it's an enormous challenge.
Just from the U.S. perspective, there are 3 different vaccines that they are donating at the moment. Each of the vaccines may have its own transportation requirements, cold storage requirements.
And most countries have their own regulatory requirements. Rebecca Weintraub at Harvard Medical School says right now that is one of the biggest hurdles.
Some countries have decided to conduct clinical trials on their local populations before authorizing the use of the vaccine. You can imagine the delay.
Many countries also need other supplies in addition to the vaccine, says Ala Valente at the research company Forrester.
What those countries need is, first of all, to be able to have the syringes that they need to administer the vaccine.
They also need enough people who are trained and authorized to give shots. Valente says both of those are things the U.S. could help supply.
If the U.S. also contributed the human capital to be able to go to these countries and help with that distribution effort, I think that would go a long way.
And there is a very long way to go. In most countries in Africa, for example, less than 1% of the population has been vaccinated. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders don't care about Jay Powell. They don't care about vaccines. They are just doing their thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On the docket of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry tomorrow is a hearing entitled Examining Markets, Transparency, and Prices from Cattle Producer to Consumer. In other words, how meatpackers buy cattle and whether how they do it makes your burger more expensive. There is some pressure in Washington for an overhaul of the $213 billion meatpacking industry, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Retail meat prices have remained pretty high since the pandemic started because of limited processing capacity and lots of demand. It's great news for companies that dominate the meat processing space. Think JBS, Smithfield, and Tyson. For farmers, not so much.
Farmers don't usually complain about this kind of thing unless the numbers are on their side.
That's Stephanie Mercier with the Farm Journal Foundation.
They're not getting what they think is their fair share, so they're starting to raise concerns about it.
Concerns about a consolidated meatpacking industry having too much leverage. Kit Tovar Jensen is an agriculture lawyer at Iowa State University.
There's only so many options for producers. They just don't have as many options to go anywhere else.
Farmers have accused meatpacking companies of monopolistic practices for years. In February, JBS subsidiary Pilgrim's Pride was told to pay a $108 million criminal fine for fixing poultry prices. The North American Meat Institute, which represents meatpackers, says any new regulation would, quote, limit a producer's ability to market their livestock the way they see fit and will lead to costly lawsuits, end quote. But the USDA says it's time to update the 100-year-old Packers and Stockyards Act, a law that Jeffrey Peterson, an agribusiness attorney in Minnesota, says has always been pretty vague.
It prohibits packers and live poultry dealers from engaging in or using any unfair, unjustly discriminatory or deceptive practices, and also from making or giving any undue or unreasonable preference or advantage. That's a mouthful.
And he says it's often difficult and expensive for farmers to prove that's going on. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wherever the business and economic news takes you, David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report will get it to you first thing. Check it out. The effects of the pandemic have been uneven on both people and on businesses and industries. Hurt some, helped others. And now that we're trying to get back to normal, we are finding in a lot of cases that normal has changed. The landscape is different in a kind of a literal sense. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is our go-to for all things plants.
Plants began to grow on land around 500 million years ago. Last year, they reached Laura Wang's apartment.
I started buying plants on Etsy and Facebook groups.
Wang lives in Oakland, California, where lockdown started early.
I didn't go outside for like the first 3 months of the pandemic. And so I was inside a studio apartment.
So she brought nature indoors, one plant at a time.
And I would say we have like over 100 now.
She grew her plants. She imported plants.
But like basic, just from Ecuador, because it's cheaper there.
And of course, with plants, you need supplies.
Grow lights and heating pads and some like humidity containers. Oh, the big thing is that I wanted to buy predatory mites.
Predatory mites to eat certain insect pests. Huang's boyfriend vetoed that.
He doesn't want to bring more bugs into the apartment.
Anyway, Wang estimates she spent around $1,000 total on plants. And according to the Census Bureau, all across the U.S., Americans, including aspiring plant moms and plant dads, spent $8.5 billion more on gardening equipment and supplies in 2020 than they did in 2019, an increase of nearly 20%. Sonia De Trinidad owns Partly Sunny Projects. She sells succulents and air plants online.
I went from maybe doing, you know, an acceptable 30, 40 orders per month to June of 2020, where I did 1,200 orders.
Her TikTok gained hundreds of thousands of followers. She's up to 360,000 now.
I got a lot of people that commented about how the plants were helping them with their depression, their anxiety, working through their sad days.
Now, the question is whether this plant momentum will stick around. Because, you know, for all the plant parents, you've also got this guy, Kevin Broccoli in Johnston, Rhode Island.
shortly into the pandemic, I decided to buy this make your own herb garden situation, which was 9 plants.
He killed all of them. Every last one.
I mean, I have the pots. The pots are still here. There's just nothing in them at the moment. I think it's a really good metaphor for the pandemic in general, because, you know, beginning of the pandemic, nothing going on. I have nothing to do but take care of these plants.
They were looking great, but then things got busy. Work picked up.
And I started seeing one by one them just dropping off slowly.
This is actually what happens to plants during recessions and recoveries. They do well, and then they don't.
We normally see increases in sales anytime there's any sort of economic downturn.
Dr. Charlie Hall is an economist and professor of horticultural science at Texas A&M.
You know, when the recession is over, the downturn's over, and people start making that switch to durable goods purchases again, buying more cars and refrigerators and furniture and so forth, that's when we really take it on the chin.
But Hall says this recession is looking different so far. People have started buying non-plant stuff, but they're also still buying more plants. Again, Sonia De Trinidad with Partly Sunny Projects.
I believe that there are definitely some mass murders happening in the plant community right now. But I think that people are also very determined to make it work.
And a lot of people are still working from home and may still want some plant company. Gardening-related sales so far in 2021 are up 30% from last year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's like a flag or a monument.
Or it's like money. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 68 points today, 0.2%, closed at 33,945. The NASDAQ gained 111 points. It's about 0.7%, 14,253. The S&P 500 up 21.5%, finished at 42.46. American Airlines gave back 1.5% today, after announcing it's going to cut hundreds of flights to avoid potential strain on its operations. Delta went the other way, down 0.8%. Actually, it's the same way, down 0.8%. United Airlines off 0.9%. New figures today from the National Association of Realtors shows home prices rose more than 20% in the 12 months ended May. That is a new annual record. The inventory of homes for sale, perhaps related, fell more than 20% in the same period. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Soccer fans will know that Euro 2020 is going on right now. Yes, 2020, not a typo. But while the soccer world is looking at Europe, I spent some time last week at Banc of California Stadium, about 5 minutes from downtown LA. It's a soccer-specific stadium, home at the moment to the Los Angeles Football Club of the men's Major League Soccer, and soon home to Angel City Football Club, which is going to join the National Women's Soccer League next spring.
Nice to see you. How are you?
Good to meet you. Hi.
Oh, man, you guys have your own masks?
Of course, we have our own masks. You do.
Julie Ehrman's the president and a co-owner of Angel City, which, of course, meant that we got to sit in the owner's box.
Up the stairs?
Nope, straight.
No?
Straight.
Oh.
And here we are.
Perfect. Excellent. Let's find a place in the shade as they mow the lawn.
If you've heard a thing or two about this team, it's probably because of its owners and investors and its origin story. Natalie Portman at an event with former women's national team great Abby Wambach.
Yeah, Natalie was listening to Abby Wambach talk about how retirement for female athletes is so different than male athletes. Abby was getting the Icon Award at the ESPYs at the same time as Kobe and Peyton Manning, and they were talking about where to spend their hundreds of millions of dollars, and Abby was trying to figure out how to make her mortgage. And it really stuck with Natalie to the extent that when she left the talk, she started asking why. They're the best in the world. She's the best at her sport. Why is it so different for women than men? And then it was, well, if I want to affect change, I need to have a seat at the table. So it was her idea to launch Angel City Football Club.
The team's investors are mostly women, including Wambach and more than a dozen other national team players and a bunch of celebrities as well.
It's unbelievable. They understand that we're building something bigger than a game here, and they want to be here and be a part of it. It's not just about writing a check. It's about really being part of the community.
You are a digital media executive person. You're not a sports person. How'd you wind up here?
Well, I'm an athlete. I grew up playing basketball. I'm a huge sports fan, born and raised here in Los Angeles. But as an entrepreneur, as a media person, as a gaming executive, I know how to build communities, and I know how to build products, and I know how to entertain. And that's really what sports is. You have to create an entertaining experience. We're doing it differently by leading with purpose, but I'm able to bring all of my skill sets together for something that I truly love, which is sports.
So as we were walking in, and I don't know if that'll make the final edit or not, but we talked about this is actually more than just a soccer club.
It is.
It's a brand that you're building. Explain the intentionality behind that.
We want Angel City to be a global brand, because if we're a global brand...
Global brand is a big swing. Come on.
We want to be on the same stage as the New York Yankees and Barcelona.
Good for you. Look, and good for you. But
we're building Angel City as if we are a platform. And this platform stands for equality and impact. So we view Angel City Football Club as the first expression of the platform. And our goal is to launch other products and service and entertainment products underneath the global brand that is Angel City.
Like what?
Could be an esports team. Could be an esports league. We could launch our own tequila line. I mean, at the end of the day, as long as our values are the same and we're striving for equality and equity, you know, the sky's the limit as far as what kind of product we can bring to market.
When you got this job, what were the first, like, five things you figured you had to do?
I had to learn the business of sports, right? I built other products, but I didn't even know how to go about building a sports business. And so you talked about this aspiration of being a global brand being so big, but as an entrepreneur and trying to learn about sports, I went to look for the best examples. So, you know, if we want to be the best, we need to be a platform like City Football Group and understand how can we commercialize this and drive it to profitability. How can we get the fandom and the engagement of the community like Barcelona and create real sense of ownership with our fans? And then what is uniquely Angel City that came from the earliest conversations that Natalie had was purpose. So how does Angel City combine purpose and brand and a platform together? And I went about building that. And so then I learned, what are the ins and outs of a soccer team? Like, what are my expenses and my revenue? And what is the story that's going to galvanize a community in Los Angeles where there's already 11 professional sports teams?
Right. So what is the story of Angel City?
We strive to set higher expectations on and off the pitch. We want to elevate women's sports and specifically women's soccer and show that it is as good, if not better, than any other professional sports team here. And it deserves the attention and the revenue that the male teams just get without trying.
There are, I think this coming spring, there'll be 12 teams, right?
Correct.
What have your conversations been like with other ownership groups about the ambitions that this team has?
Because
you guys are getting a lot of press. You're getting a lot of oomph, right? Because of where you are, because of who your leadership group is, and because of, frankly, the power of the women. So what kind of conversations are you having?
Look, we are an open playbook, and we talk to all the clubs about what it is and what we're building. We have been really successful in building community. We have nearly a half a dozen founding sponsors today at real valuations.
That's before minute one has been played, which is kind of amazing.
Before minute one, before we have a single
player, before we have a coach.
And so again, as we think about how do we lead with passion and purpose to drive to profitability, when we started talking to brands, we launched the Angel City sponsorship model. So we give 10% of our revenue back to the communities through our social impact platform. It's bringing brands into sports that have never thought about sports sponsorship ever. One of our jersey sponsors is a company called Birdies, which is a direct-to-consumer women's footwear company. They're an early-stage company themselves, but they see the mission alignment, and they recognize that our audience will come if they support Angel City. And for their 10%, we're doing a whole program around female mentorship, and we have interns today learning about women in sports and entrepreneurship and what it takes to be part of a sports team.
I don't want to end on a downer, but at the end of the day, you got to win games.
You have to win games. We are building an incredible soccer operations team led by Enya Luko. She's a former English national team player. Most recently was the general manager of Aston Villa Women. We have an incredibly exciting announcement to make soon about our coach. Players aren't far behind.
You could break it right here.
I could if I knew who we were favoring of our short list, but we are super close. But it's coming. And then we get to start telling stories about the players and about the sport, and we can start following them on their journey to becoming an Angel City Football Club player and to our first game.
When's the expansion draft?
The expansion cramp is in the winter.
Okay.
And then we have the amateur college draft in January.
Okay. And first game is when?
April of 22.
Julie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Cryptocurrency is a thing right now. I know, volatility notwithstanding. Bitcoin was down below $30,000 at one point today, half its most recent high. But the truth is, we are still far, far away from being a truly cashless society. And until that happens, we're going to need to keep on making money, like actually making the money. That's where the British company De La Rue comes in. They design a third of the world's banknotes, and they do that by hiring people like this.
My name is Aaron McIntosh, and I am a banknote designer. Maybe the most important part of a banknote design is that it serves as a piece of national identity. It's like a flag or a monument. A banknote represents a country, but it's in everyone's pocket. So there's lots of careful decisions about who and what should appear on the banknote and which symbols that we use as well. I used to love puzzle games, and I feel like trying to fit the complicated parts of a note design is like a game of Tetris. You have the graphics that are an awkward shape, like a bank logo or a coat of arms, and they can only go in certain places, and there need to be a certain gap between them to make everything print properly in the factory. And we don't want to cause a paper jam on a printer that's the size of a truck. It's a mixture of kind of art and science. It can take years between starting a design and it being in the public. So the coolest thing about my job, it's really exciting to go to an ATM or a cash machine and you see a piece of your artwork come out and you see people around you and they open their wallets to fetch a note that you helped design. It's really exciting to know that you can sort of nudge someone and go, open your wallet, I did that. But a lot of people maybe don't pay attention or they haven't taken the time to appreciate it. So I think that's one thing that drives us to be better and more creative and to come up with something more exciting and unique, because then when it comes out, people will really take notice of it, or they'll be excited by it as well.
That piece came to us from Million Bazillion. That's a podcast we do for kids and their families, answering all the questions kids have about money. New episodes out every Tuesday this summer on the platform of your choice. Final note on the way out today, which I kind of love. Did you know that astronauts don't, or can't, I guess, wash their clothes in space? So they just wear them until they're completely gross. And remember, they work out 2 hours a day up there to maintain body and muscle mass. Anyway, they get gross and then they chuck them. They put them in a cargo capsule and let them burn up in the atmosphere. I told you that so I could tell you this. The Associated Press reports that Procter & Gamble is doing a project with NASA, sending a pair of Tide detergent and stain removal experiments to the space station later this year and next. Because, I mean, honestly, what are astronauts going to do when we get back to the moon, let alone Mars, right? All right, we're going. But here is your moment of economic context from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. This item, the great state of Arizona announced earlier this month it didn't have enough aluminum to make license plates. They have since secured a second source, but there is a supply chain story everywhere, people. I'm telling you, everywhere. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, and Janet Wins. Tarnieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.